In her new book, The Light of the World, Elizabeth Alexander, inaugural poet, mother, and wife, finds herself at an existential crossroads after the sudden death of her husband, who was just 50. Reflecting with gratitude on the exquisite beauty of her married life that was, grappling with the subsequent void and feeling of a re-energized devotion to her two teenage sons, Alexander channels her poetic sensibilities into prose that describes a very personal and yet universal quest for meaning, understanding, and acceptance, taking stock of herself at the mid-century mark. The name of the book is The Light of the World. Professor Elizabeth Alexander is a poet, essayist, playwright, and teacher. She holds degrees from Yale, Boston University, and the University of Pennsylvania. In 2009, she composed and delivered Praise Song for the Day for the inauguration of President Barack Obama. She is currently a chancellor of the Academy of American Poets and the inaugural Frederick Iseman Professor of Poetry at Yale University. It's a great pleasure to welcome Elizabeth Alexander to the roundtable this morning. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about how this came to be, you wanting to write this story, which I assume basically comes after the sudden death of your husband.
Well, I have to say that I didn't want to write it. It really kind of grabbed me by the scruff of the neck and demanded to be written. After my husband passed away so unexpectedly a few days after his 50th birthday, I began writing little things that didn't even feel like writing. I think it was my way of grounding myself, of knowing what I was experiencing, not so much anything cathartic, but rather this is where we are, and I have to write it. These were phrases. This wasn't anything that looked like a book. And a few months later, I told no one, and a few months later, an editor who I knew a little bit asked me if I thought that I could write a memoir, thought that I could write something that was beautiful. And I am very private. I never imagined I'd write a memoir. I didn't like the idea of it, but something said, you're already doing it, keep doing it. And the book proceeded from there.
That is a fascinating process because the privacy takes over, that you want to write it for you, but then there is that idea that someday perhaps others will read it.
Well, yes, and before even getting to that stage, of course, the first others would be my sons, who are
right
now teenagers. And that was a very important part of the process, that I didn't want to anticipate how they would feel about having our lives and our sorrow, but also our joy, exposed to a larger audience. I didn't know how they would feel about being exposed in that way, even though it is the boys in the book, but it's also the boys as written characters, if you know what I mean. And I checked with them and read the book to them. They didn't want to read it themselves. They wanted me to read it to them at two stages. And they talked back to me about it. It happened this way. It didn't happen that way. We cried. We laughed. We remembered the very, very joyful and beautiful things. And ultimately, they said that it was a book that they would want to read and that they felt comfortable letting it out. So I don't imagine ever having that to deal with in such a particular way again.
What do you think there is about that idea of being 50, of thinking of middle age and just the aging process as a whole and having that life being taken away? I mean, it does seem that plays a very large role, is the timing of it, right? That of being that age and being so young.
Well, it's crazy, isn't it? I mean, whatever 50 is the new whatever it is,
right.
I think that certainly we felt ourselves to be at a wonderful stage in life where many, many, many beautiful things were ahead. And so to lose Fikre so suddenly was kind of not anywhere on the radar. It was unimaginable to me at that point. But I think that in moving forward and knowing instantly that even though there would be tremendous, tremendous suffering for me and for my children and for the people who knew him, I also knew that we were still alive and that his legacy of creative living, of being someone who really stood for justice, being someone who had a kind of generosity and open-armed approach to the world, being someone who had lived through war but had more of a capacity for joy than anyone I ever met, I knew that that was the legacy that we had, and we were still alive. And so, you know, we keep on living.
You write so beautifully of your time together and also of what it is like to move on. And there's a beautiful chapter in the book about a hurricane coming through and having to deal with that without your husband and just knowing you'll be fine, but that realization that he's not there to deal with what he used to be dealing with.
Yes, and there were many things like that. In that chapter, what happens is that my sons know what to do. And it turns out they have been watching. I think that you know, for parents, when we realized that our kids actually were listening and were paying attention when we told them 900 times what to do or showed them, sometimes not even thinking we were setting an example. I think that children are paying attention is one of the very important parts of that chapter. And I think what that also means for young people who suffer loss that we wish they didn't have to suffer is that they still keep with them so much that is indelible of the person, the parent who loved them.
You write in that chapter, "We are doing better, I know. I am not allowing myself full and deep sleep. I am vigilant. Sleep brings death too close." Do you still feel that way?
I think certainly not as much as I did. And there's a chapter at towards the end of the book where I write, death sits in a comfortable chair in my bedroom. He's there when I wake up. I see him there. He's smoking a cigarette. You know, I can see him plainly. He sits there and we cohabit. He doesn't come near. He's not going to take me tonight. And so I think that, and then I go on to assert that the life force really is mighty, and that even though the truth is death waits for all of us, I think that because we can't do anything about that, the question is, how do we live? And how do we each find a balance of living with the awareness that life is precious, which I think is a great thing. I mean, I think in that regard, you know, knowing that life is not infinite makes us take it more seriously and fill it with more beauty and joy. But how do you also not live life paralyzed by the fear of the inevitable? That's not a way to live.
He was an artist, he was a chef, and you say toward the end of the book that as you go to bed and as you wake up every morning, you see his work, you see one of his paintings.
Yes, it's a painting called Visitation that he wrote early in our days together. We were such supporters of each other's painting and poetry that I sometimes get the two mixed up. It's an allegory of our first meeting in his studio. We came together very quickly and decided to make a life together, and so in the painting, he sees as angels our children who have not yet been born. He portrays as angels some of his ancestors. And so I think that understanding of the continuity of life and death, you know, that there's a great African-American expression, every shut-eye ain't asleep, every goodbye ain't gone, which is to say that even when we lose people, and even in the deep, deep sorrow and ache of that, there is still the way that they are with us. And he exemplified that for me right from the beginning.
There is, again, toward the end of the book, you write that it's not easy to die, sweetie. Vickery used to say to me when I'd have night terrors and wake in a panic, "I've seen people survive, and I know. I'd always had bad dreams, and his words and presence were all that ever calmed me down. It's not easy to die. Life force is actually mighty, and I have life force. It is not indelible, but it can behave like it is. We all die, but we don't die easily." Does that put his death into some perspective because he had said those words to you?
Well, I think that it made me think about the fact that even though he certainly died an untimely death, that he lived such a rich life. He did not live long enough, but he lived fully. As I say, this is a man who found his life's work three times. Before he was a chef or a painter, he was an activist. He did all of those things with brilliance. He came from a loving family, lived through war, walked out of his country, made a whole new life for himself, which I think anybody who makes a new life in a new place, my hat's off to them. I find that I really idolize that people have that kind of tenacity and strength, and that everything he did, he spread joy, he spread light, he spread beauty, he spread integrity. So that's a lot of living, that's a lot of life force, and that's not something that's easily extinguished, even as we mourn his passing.
You write that it was, you call him the ghost of all bookstores. It was difficult for you to go into a bookstore after he passed.
Yes, he had read more. We each of us had read more than anyone the other knew. We read different things. We shared books and shared ideas all the time. And one of our favorite things to do, the two of us, and also with the children, was to go and get lost in bookstores. To find each other hours later, sitting in a corner, reading a book. And so, really, I would go to the door of bookstores and turn around and walk out because it just filled me with too much sadness. I think that there's a way that we feel the presence of the people that we lose in those spaces, and sometimes it's just a matter of time before we can go back, but that's sometimes what happens. Now, when I go to bookstores, it is an emotionally pleasant, though heavy, feeling to feel that he's the ghost of all bookstores.
What was it like looking back on events in your life, and I guess I'm thinking mostly of the reading the inaugural poem, of just the enormity of that event in your life. And does it change looking back on it now that he has passed in any way? Do you look at it differently?
I don't look at it differently, though I note with tremendous gratitude what it meant to have such a wonderful partner going through such an enormous experience as that, not only to share it, but he was also the only person with whom I shared my poems and drafts, just as he shared all of his paintings and drafts, all 882 of them, every poem, every word I wrote in our time together, I showed to him and to him alone, and we would tell each other with brutal honesty what we thought, and we made each other better, and we believed in each other. So I feel really, really lucky that going through that crazy, unprecedented moment in history, that I had the best possible coach and supporter and partner one could imagine.
So as you said at the beginning of our conversation, of having, going into this project kind of by the scruff of the neck, it is, what is it like then to write, and especially a memoir in a form that you have not written in extensively, to do that without him?
Well, it's actually turned out to be a very important thing. I feel that the circumstances of what happened, and so by that regard, not Fikre directly, but those circumstances led me to do write in a new way that I'm actually very proud of. I went in by the scruff of the neck, but I've come out on the other side writing something that started as a poet writes, but turned into something that I think is powerful and beautiful, and that I'm really, really proud of. So I do feel like that is Fikre's ongoing presence in my life. He'll never not inspire me to try new things and to honor what it means that I can write.
When you talk about that of writing as a poet and there being a transformation, there still is that poetic precision and that poetic beauty in the work, though.
Well, thanks. You know, that's kind of how I know what to do, is to go word by word, very, very small. I, you know, I'm not a long-form person. The chapters, as you know, are very small and concentrated,
right.
And that's how I... That's how I use language, but also that kind of precision was actually the only way I could know what was happening to me, the only way that I could fix what I was going through, the only way that I could look really, really sharply before I got too far away from it. Because, you know, I think sometimes in the early days, of course, I knew I would never forget our family life. I knew I would never forget Fikre, but I felt a desperate need to fix it. And so having very, very precise tools was the best way to do it.
And I'm constantly in awe of that ability to be able to say so much in so few words. Did that come fairly naturally, given the closeness of the subject and the guttural reaction? Or was there still a lot of rewriting and reworking?
Oh, how I labored.
Yes.
It was really, 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 really hard work. Writing is always hard, and that's
sure.
fine, because it should be, right? I mean, you know, if you're going to do something that's good, it's okay for it to take labor. When you add to it, though, that this was, you know, not too long after his loss, there was also just... sort of weeping my way through the writing sessions on top of it. So it was written in a very, very concentrated period of time, because I don't think that I could have sustained staying in that state for much longer.
Given this realization and how you have come to write this, do you think it has changed you in any distinct way as a writer?
I know that it has changed me enormously, although I think of it less as change and more as evolution.
Mm.
So I know that I am really valuing, as this book starts to move out into the world, the clarity with which it is able to give something to other people. I have gotten such a powerful response. When it was excerpted in The New Yorker, hundreds of strangers emailed me with mostly not actually stories of losing a spouse, but all kinds of stories of love and loss. I treasure those stories that come my way, and I'm kind of amazed to think that in such a direct way, this book is touching people, and that I'm hearing from people that in their own loss and sorrow, that it offers them something. I mean, I am really humbled by that and kind of astonished, because we're right at the beginning of it. So that's just really fascinating.
Have you written poetry since then? Are you still writing poems?
I have not written poetry since then. This book feels like it sort of came from the same wellspring that poetry comes from,
mm-hmm.
the same language bank, the same place. And so, you know, I took all the money out of the bank and I put it into this book, and things will need to fill up again. I think once a poet, always a poet. You know, that is my primary artistic identity. But I think that also to understand that in a limited way on my part would be a mistake. I think that the important thing is to keep writing and to be an open and evolving artist and to see where it takes you, because it's a gift that is not guaranteed. So I think that I have to listen to what it wants from me.
So you don't miss it, because there still is that artistic expression that is coming out.
Well, and there hasn't been any time. I mean, I really kind of just finished this book.
Yeah.
So I think even if it were a book of poems, I would feel like I get a little bit of a rest now. and that what is, you know, the now part is the sharing the book with people and, you know, letting the well fill up again.
Well, the name of the book is The Light of the World. It is a memoir. It is published by Grand Central. Elizabeth Alexander, it's such a beautiful and just gorgeous book, and I thank you so much for it and for sharing with us this morning. A great pleasure.
Well, thank you. This was a terrific conversation, and I really appreciate all of your engagement with my book, which is, of course, very dear to me. Thank you.
Indeed. Thank you so much. Again, the name of the book is The Light of the World, a memoir by Elizabeth Alexander. It is published by Grand Central. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.